This week on Walter Edgar's Journal, my guest is Michael Biedenbaugh, who is the executive director of the Palmetto Trust for Historic Preservation. It's a statewide organization, but its headquarters isn't in Charleston. It isn't in Greenville. It isn't in Columbia. It's in Prosperity, South Carolina. Michael, tell us why you're located or headquartered in Prosperity.
Well, Walter, thank you so much. It's the reason we're in Prosperity is because one of our buildings that we restored is in Prosperity. And we've been in Columbia for a while, and we have the South Carolina Department of Archives and History to thank for allowing us to have a space to work out of. But in the growth of the organization and in more of the statewide reach, we thought it was important for us to be in the buildings that we're restoring. And the opportunity came in Prosperity, which also happens to be where I have lived, my family has lived for 200 years.
I thought that might happen.
And the depot is something that's very personal to me. I've personally been focused on restoring that depot since I was on the town council in the 90s there in Prosperity. So once it was completed, the board got together and we talked and said, you know, there was two offices there. Said, let's do this. So how long we'll be there, we don't know. If when another building comes up, I like the idea of moving around in different areas. You know, we're a statewide organization, and as long as we're in the Midlands area, we can have reach all over the state and still represent the interest of everybody that loves preservation around the state.
Well, you know, actually with technology, you could just about be located anywhere, and you do have projects going statewide. I think having been associated with your group when it was getting off the ground, what y'all have done in the last few years is absolutely incredible.
Thank you, Walter.
Besides your headquarters building, before we get into your projects, let's talk how the Palmetto Trust for Historic Preservation operates.
Well, the Palmetto Trust was formed in 1990, of which you were part of the steering committee for, as a nonprofit statewide organization made up of 14. Right now we have 14 board of directors from all over the state. And we operate as a nonprofit whose mission is to preserve and protect the endangered structures, historic structures of South Carolina. And so we do that through advocacy and communication and education, but also through a real estate program where we actually go in and either accept as donation dilapidated buildings, but also will purchase if that's necessary through an endangered places fund that we have to go in and capture these places, stabilize them, and put them back in the marketplace with covenants and easements to ensure that the new owners will take the responsibility of maintaining and we protect them in perpetuity.
Things like the Benjamin Mays Homestead, wasn't that one of your...
That was one of the ones that we were involved in. That was before I came on board in 2007. I was on the board. I had a marketing company in the 1990s, and I was on the board of the Palmetto Trust then. And right after I got off the board, that's when that happened, and that was with one of our chairmen, Frank Wideman, and the Self Foundation and all of those folks in Greenwood did a great job of saving that place.
Well, and looking at the organization over the years, you're offering advice, protection, support in particularly rural areas where there isn't an active ongoing preservation movement.
It's not, but it's also in areas where, you know, we have the opportunity to educate and communicate how good preserving buildings is. Unfortunately, in South Carolina and all over the country, it's the case that there seems to be, especially among the development community and among the professional community, they assume something old means it's not as good. And that's something we constantly come across when county councils are determining, well, do we keep our old courthouse or do we need to build a new one that's new and upgraded and has all the new systems? And that's somewhat seductive to people who think, wow, we can have something new. And we try to step in and say, well, you know, what you have is better than anything you could build. And that discussion has taken place in York. And so we've been working very closely with the community of York about their old courthouse and having to also educate that to repair and rehabilitate these old places does not mean it's more expensive. There is a trend to assume that it is. Mm-hmm. And it takes very specialized people to understand how it doesn't have to be. Unfortunately, a lot of people replace a lot more than they have to. You know, and one of the things that has been very disturbing is the insistence to believe historic windows are not as good as new windows. And that's a bit of education that is hard to overcome the multi-million dollar marketing that goes behind new aluminum windows. And it is just absolutely tragic to see heart pine windows pegged. Some of the finest woodwork in these old houses was in the windows. And to see them perfectly fine, made out of heart of 500-year-old trees thrown in a trash dump. It's a loss that can never be replaced, because there's this type of wood is extinct, for one thing. It's not around anymore. And so those type of education elements and that advocacy is what we try to step in and say, wait a minute, let's show you that you don't have to do that. And we can save money. And these places can be rehabilitated for less than $150 a square foot and not the $250 a square foot that many try to say it does.
Well, you are a nonprofit. You have to raise money. And sometimes, like in Greenville with the Wilkins House, your fundraising focuses on a particular community and a particular project. You know, when I first got the notice that you were going to move the Wilkins House, I thought, that thing is solid brick. And I mean solid brick. It's not brick veneer.
Well, it is. And let me tell you, it had some of the most incredible brick foundations. In moving that house, it was really tragic that those foundations had to be destroyed. They were amazing. Yes, yeah, solid brick. And the interior walls were solid brick, too. We're talking 18 inches to 2 foot thick brick walls inside. On the hallways inside.
So how do you move a building that weighs 750 tons?
By getting people that know what they're doing. There were several things that happened in Greenville to make this work that usually doesn't happen when all of a sudden you hear a organization or development group has purchased this piece of property. You know, how can we save the house? You know, so then the first thing you do is go to the people who bought it and try to figure out how they can incorporate the house into their use. With this group, it wasn't going to be discussed. The plans were already made. The house was in the way. So then it's about, okay, how can we use it for other things? You see, the biggest thing about preservation is not only preserving the structures, but preserving some economic viability that make them sustainable.
Well, I mean, let's be honest, the days of house museums, not that it's over because there are successful house museums, but that's not what you're about and that's not what the preservation movement's about anymore.
Well, it's not. I mean, there are places for that. I mean, the magnificent place at Kensington there in Eastover, yeah. Would that ever be anything but a museum? We don't know. And there is some use for that. However, there are too many historic places, too many places that matter to communities. It's impossible to make them all museums. And it was the economy that built them, and it has to be economy to sustain them. So what made this work in Greenville was a gentleman by the name of Neil Wilson, a local businessman, came forward and said, I'll invest in its rehabilitation if it could be moved.
Okay.
That's what did it. Not only were the property owner who had purchased the property willing to give us time to move it and said, I'll let you move it if you get it out of the way, but Neil Wilson being able to come forward and said, I'll take it and restore it if we can get it moved.
Okay, so that project now is in your lap. What does Michael Biedenbaugh do to figure out how to move a solid brick building? I'm trying to get my head around this.
One becomes working with a team and looking at how to bridge this gap of $300,000, which was the shortfall in the whole economic model. We had a shortfall of $300,000.
The shortfall for what?
The cost of the move.
The cost of moving.
And that wasn't all. The cost of the move actually was close to about $360,000. And that was the original goal we had. Let's try to make this happen for $360,000 and go into a community that was already stressed because of the loss of buy-low out of the community. And a lot of the philanthropy was trying to bridge that shortfall with the Peace Center and all these, the zoo. And, you know, looking at it on a piece of paper, it was really one of the biggest leap of faith we ever had. But, you know, one of the things that I've learned is that if you allow these places to speak for themselves and give them the opportunity, it's amazing what can come out if you just give them the chance. And so we just stood there and said, okay, we're going to try to raise $360,000. This is what it's going to take to save the house. Let's start. Let's start marketing and try to make this happen. Now, let's find a house mover who can do this. And after several House movers looked at it, Wolf, which is a very large organization centered in Pennsylvania, they have an office in North Carolina, they came down and met with Neil and their professionalism and their confidence. I mean, it was just, they came and didn't even blink an eye. Yeah, no problem, is what they said. No problem. We can bring in the steel. We can bring in the equipment. And if you get a chance to look, we did make a documentary about it. It's on our website, palmettotrust.org, and we have it on our YouTube channel as well as on our video page. It's 7 minutes, and it goes all into how they did it. But I've never seen the technology for this. The thing is, the old days, and we've moved several houses before. If you remember the Lindner House, which mm-hmm. was a two-story log cabin outside of Irmo when they were building a Walmart. And, you know, this was the traditional house mover that had the rails, had the big Mack truck, hooked it up, and just pulled it with his Mack truck 100 feet. Well, the technology of this is definitely 21st century. These folks came in, and they had the steel alone that went up underneath that house and built a bed of steel underneath those two-foot-thick brick walls weighed 50 tons alone. So the total weight, the 750-ton house, and then the 50 tons, we had 800 tons that had to sit on rubber tires.
Whew.
180 tires, little pods that had eight tires each. And each one was hydraulically connected to each other. They were sitting under a hydraulic lift so that as the house moved, any little bump in the road, the hydraulic lifts would connect with each other so that if one went down, all of them went down. So the house went lean and tilt. It was absolutely incredible.
Well, and also since you're moving something like a brick structure, if you didn't have that, things would start to crack.
That's right. And so you had that. But the most astonishing thing was how all this moved was electronically. A little joystick that the guy had in his hand walking alongside with the little buttons moving it along. Now, it went very slow.
So this wasn't being pulled by a Big Mac truck?
No. It was being moved like an electronic dolly.
Oh.
It was incredible. And Greenville, you know, we had to close Mills Avenue and all this. All of Greenville, people were lining the streets to watch this. And Channel 4 brought out their chopper to show it in the air, and it was an amazing day to watch this thing turn and move and then go back.
Well, you know, it looked to me like it was a party atmosphere. People cheering.
Yeah.
You know, that's great.
It is.
That's absolutely great.
It is. It was a tragedy. It had to be moved to get it off of its place where it was, but it was a huge success to say that, wow, we can get this place and put it at a place where it would revive and still live on. And the interesting thing, the people who lived in the neighborhood there, that area, Mills Avenue, has not been overly commercialized yet. Most of the businesses are in 1920s and 30s one-story homes. Mm-hmm. So all of them were very excited to see this 2.5-story Italianate mansion come put right there in the middle of it because everybody was saying, oh, this will increase the value of our area.
I guess a little bit of background is the Wilkins house originally was on Augusta Road. Right?
It was originally on Augusta Road.
And that had been a very chic residential area at the turn of the last century, but it had become commercialized.
It had.
In fact, the funeral home had been next door.
Well, the funeral home had been in it. The funeral home had used it since the 1930s.
Which, you know, in southern towns was a traditional thing to do to save the big old house in town.
And the Jones mortuary folks, the lady who was born and lived in the up floor, she was there watching it happen too. It was really a fascinating reunion of people who had been impacted by this place. After Jones Mortuary left, it was an antique store and feet people that had come for that. Following that, it was a place called Augusta Manor for weddings and bridal events. And you had these young brides there watching the place that they had their memory of being married in and having their receptions in, going down the road at 0.5 mile an hour in front of them.
So once you get it to the site, is it moved onto a new foundation?
The foundation that had to be put in, the site was interesting. It was a deep site, and so dirt had to come in to fill it in. But the foundation was 4 or 5 foot thick footings and wire, and it was amazing the footings that were put into place. So basically, what happened was when we came around and moved it over on the site, then it had to be slid over the foundations, and that took another 2 weeks to do that. And so right now, where it is,
okay. How do you slide that structure? I'm still trying. I looked at it, but I still try. How do you slide?
It's on these rails.
Oh, it's still on the rails.
It's still on the rails. All the rails are still underneath. It had these huge yellow beams that were 4 foot by 60 foot. 4 foot tall by 60 foot by 4 foot wide. And then on top of those was a bed of a foot high I-beams that were literally a foot apart all the way along the length underneath. So it sat on a platform of steel. Then underneath the tires, because there were several areas where when we went, we had to cut across somebody's yard, we had to cut through a parking area, and where the dirt and gravel was filled in, they had 5 foot by 10 foot half-inch thick steel plates that they moved in front of the tire so they wouldn't get bogged down in loose dirt that had just been filled in. So that was moving along. And if you look at the film, it's amazing. We did time lapse, and you could see at the same time little forklifts moving the plates in front of the thing. On the other side, the power company's taking up power poles. There's people had to take down some trees, all happening right in front of this as it's going.
Well, see, I think one of the things that's amazing is it wasn't just something that you, the Palmetto Trust, were doing, but you obviously got folks in the community who said, okay, you can come across my yard. We'll take down trees. We'll move power poles. A lot of folks had to buy into this project.
They had to buy into it, and the conversations weren't quite that easy, but the process ended up that way. The process ended there. One of the big issues was there were two large trees on the street that were the last remnants of Mills Avenue tree corridor that used to be there. 30 years ago, the place was lined with these big willow oaks and pin oaks. There are none left now except for three. Two of them we had to take down to make it fit. And that was an issue we had to address and work through the community. And Neil, as part of the deal of taking down those trees, is going to be planting eight more around the street area. So,
well, you know, they grow fairly fast. I mean,
They do. And the thing is, they don't live very long. I mean, these oaks, these type of oaks, willow oaks and pin oaks in an urban environment might live 90 years or 100 years, and they start dying back. And these two are starting to die back. And even if we didn't take them down, we were going to have to trim them so much that they would have been matchsticks with little tiny leaves at the top. So the thing is, we had to address, and in our conversations with people there that were very concerned about the precedence of cutting down trees, which is one of the things that makes Greenville so magnificent, is its trees. So it's a legitimate issue, was what is the most irreplaceable? I mean, these two trees, if they don't come down, the house is not being moved, and it will be lost. And in 50 years, the place will be lined with trees and the house will still be there. And so it's about investment in the future. It's about planning how we want our cities to look. And we moved forward and made it happen, which was wonderful.
Well, you know, that reminds me to a good upcountry story of Van Robertson's Red Hills and Cotton. And he talked about how generations of that family had planted not for their enjoyment, but for their children and their grandchildren to enjoy.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, the archetype of the oak alleyway of our low country plantations, none of those people who planted those ever saw that, mm-hmm. ever. They knew it would be. And anybody who plants trees usually is thinking of what people, or it's an investment into their place long after they're gone. And that's what comes back around with the reason we do the preservation and focus on this. It's about investment in place and understanding that where we are and the environment where we are is bigger than just our short-term impact. You know, the investment that these people have made in these old places, the Wilkins family who built this magnificent place, the thought of that just being thrown away is, one, astonishing to me, that people would actually think, okay, well, that's disposable, when it can never be reproduced. I mean, we don't have the skill to reproduce that without costing probably 10 times what it would have cost then to even build it, just because of the lack of labor, the lack of skill, the lack of materials, all of those things. So, when you have something irreplaceable, the society has to think about how to manage it and make sure it's not lost.
Well, it's a wonderful success story, and it's a tribute to your organization. But again, it's a tribute to the Greenville
community. It is a huge tribute to the Greenville. The Greenville community came forward. Kelly Odom, who is now a board member of ours, that is a fourth-generation owner of Pickwick Pharmacy there in Greenville, very respected member of the community, came forward as leader of the task force to get the word out. And it was truly a group of folks coming together and attracting the type of resources to it. Knox White came on. We did a film about it that got a lot of word out. And, you know, by the end of the day, right, going through it, we're like, will it work? And people ask me, are you sure it's going to work? And it's like, well, it doesn't matter if we're sure it's going to work. It matters if we think it should. And you've got to give it that chance. And Greenville stepped up, and it happened.
Mike, we need to pause for a moment to let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Michael Biedenbaugh, the Executive Director of the Palmetto Trust for Historic Preservation. Okay, let's go to the other end of the state, from Greenville and the Wilkins House to Dufuski Island.
Well, this year, the two biggest projects we have is this Italianate mansion, 6,000 square foot Italianate mansion in Greenville, and this 800 square foot vernacular Gullah cottage on Dufuski. It's wonderful in that it shows the diversity of what we advocate for, what's important. And it dawned on me 30 years ago or so, when the preservation movement was coming along, people were talking about the monumental structures and why the monumental structures need to be saved. But it's really now boiling down to the monumental stories, because it's the stories that make the places matter. It makes it resonate. It makes the value of them. So when you have Wilkins, who built, you know, the successful businessman coming from New York and building this Italianate mansion, his impact on Greenville was absolutely no less than the impact of Mrs. Frances Jones, whose great-grandmother left St. Simon's Island in 1865 and came to Dufuski and built this little freedman's cottage that they lived in that was still there, and then built it on in 1890, and she helped raise funds for the Merrifield School and became one of the leaders of the island, especially during the transition period of development. So it was an amazing thing to be able to take part in both of those. It was a lot of mileage going back and forth.
Let's talk about money, because all of this takes money.
Yeah.
How were you able to preserve the Frances Jones Cottage?
Well, my first trip to Dufuski was in 2009. And being a upcountry South Carolinian, you know, I'd read about Dufuski, but I'd never been down there. But being director of the Palmetto Trust, I had several folks tell me that, you know, you need to get down there. And as luck will have it, the head of the Historic Foundation that founded that heard our interview several years ago and said, we need to get the Palmetto Trust down here and see what we have. And that's, she called me, because she heard us talk about all what we were doing. And by the beginning of 2009, made our first trip. And I was astonished at how much of the historic fabric of the Gullah people were still there. This island had anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 Gullah folks living on the island because of the oyster industry in 1900. By the time Miss Frances retired and Pat Conroy came to teach in 1969, there was the 300.
Okay, so this is the woman who was the teacher in the school before Conroy.
He came and sat at her desk. She left. And the reason she left was because integration had come in and they needed a white teacher in the school. And the school she helped build, she had to retire. And I think she wanted to. She was in her late 60s then anyway. And Pat Conroy came in and sat at the desk.
Okay. So now you have Miss Jones' house.
Now we have Miss Jones' house. And so when the development came in the 1980s, when Hague Point, Melrose, and some of these golf course developments came in, there was only 60 or so natives still living on the island. And now there's, I think, 12 or 13 left. So what we have is a dozen or so of these homes built in 1890s to 1900 that are scattered throughout on the sandy roads through the maritime forest that are getting more and more dilapidated because the owners have moved on to Savannah and it's difficult to maintain them. Now, the other issue is how to invest money into it when you don't own the building. Our normal model is to come in and purchase buildings and restore and sell. That wasn't going to happen here. The folks who own these homes took great pride in the fact that this was homes that their ancestors had, and they wanted to hold on to them. Many people have lost homes and property in the face of the development of rising property taxes. There was a great pride in that ownership. And so we stepped in with a plan to say, how about if we lease the home, invest in it for the lease, and then we can revolve the money back out, because we don't have enough to do the grant, but the money that we have is to be specifically for a revolving fund mechanism. We can invest the money in, but then we have to get it out. Normally it's through sale. We can't do that. What can we do there? Two things. One, it's a tourist destination. And heritage tourism is something on the rise, and it was none on the island in a way that people could come and stay in a real Gullah cottage. So that was the model we used for this. We approached a funding organization that's been a great supporter of ours, an organization called 1772 Foundation, and they gave us a grant for $150,000 just to see if it'll work.
And it did.
And it did. It took us 2 years for the first folks who owned the house. Miss Francis's house was one we targeted, one because it was in the worst shape. Termites had really hurt a lot of the foundation on it. And because she was such a leader in the community, we wanted that to be an example of her leadership and also let the house lead and to help build trust and faith among the other owners that we weren't there to come and take the property again.
So has this become an example for other owners on the island?
Well, it has, in the sense of we've already seen two houses that were owned by folks that came in and started investing in and stabilizing it. And, you know, we have been proselytizing the importance of the aesthetic of Dufusky, of these old homes, these sandy roads. The tourists who come in with their tour maps want to see that. It's very little of it left on our sea islands, and Dufusky has it, and that's one of the things that makes it special. So the $150,000 went into Miss Francis's house. It was just finished, and we're finishing the brick hearth, and it's done and ready to rent. And we also have it tied in to philanthropy and people give, and we have partnered with the Community Foundation of Low Country out of Hilton Head to help us raise funds to help replenish that $150,000. And now we have our second house that's already been signed.
Oh, wow.
This house was built by Gullah, but it was always owned by white families that lived on the island since 1910. It was the Henson White. He was a sharecropper on the Hague Point plantation. They had been there for two generations, and this house was owned by a family that used it as their home and vacation home, and they saw what we were doing, and they were very interested in saying, we want to support what you're doing. Can our house help? So we have a lease with their house. We're rehabilitating it, and it will also be used to fund any of the money that comes in on the tourist rentals will help fund the other Gullah houses in the island. So right now we have two, and we're looking at others now to start building. Okay. So now that we have this successful on these two, over the next year, we expect others to feel more comfortable to work with us, and we hope so, because there's a lot of wonderful places that could be saved.
Right. Just out of curiosity, is the school still there?
The school is still there and wonderful. And in fact, Miss Francis lived right across from the school. So where Miss Francis's house is, which is underneath one of the most magnificent live oaks in the Low Country, sitting a beautiful sight, across the road is the school, down the road is the church.
All right, who owns the school?
The church does.
The church?
The Union Baptist Church there that has been there since the 1880s owns. And the church is still active with a minister and a congregation. Now, the congregation's mostly made up of folks who have moved there in the past 30 years. But it is still active, and it is a centerpiece of the community. And now we're able to add Miss Francis's house to that, and to help tell that richer story. One of the things that's amazing about Miss Francis is, in all of these places, when you restore them, they reveal their history. There's a lot of prejudice that people say, oh, well, it was only built in 1890, only 1890. But then you go in there and start peeling it off, and the house starts telling you, no, 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 there's more here. And that's when we discovered this freedman's cottage that was only one room that was built out of materials and using methods of mid-19th century building methods. And at first, I thought it might have been a slave cabin that had been moved from one of the plantations. We later found out in an interview with Miss Francis that she said her family came here in 1865, and this is where her family lived. So we theorized that her great-grandmother and then built this house in a very similar method of what they lived in on St. Simon's. But the thing that's amazing is because now when you go to Dufusky, it's forested and beautiful old pines and trees, but in 1865, it was pretty much one big, huge cotton field with trees and shade here and there.
Sea Island cotton.
Sea Island cotton, absolutely. But this house, whoever put this here, Miss Francis' great-grandparents, were able to put their house underneath this magnificent tree. That said something about their leadership, their sense of where they wanted to be, their permanent home. and the tree and the house has been married to each other ever since. And it's one of the most important aspects. Many times when I introduce people who live on the island what we're doing, they say, which house is that? I said, the one with the tree. Oh, thank God. Oh, that's so nice. So the house communicates itself along with the tree. That it's a marriage of both.
And you've got a place in Eastover, South Carolina, right in the Midlands?
Right in the Midlands. This was a story we've been working on for a while and one we're really excited about. In 2008, we discovered this magnificent home covered in bamboo that had been neglected. 10% of the roof was off. And we went to work building relationships. It took us about two or so years to be able to acquire it with help from Richland County Conservation Commission. And enough cannot be said about the impact of Richland County Conservation Commission for the county to support having an organization to be able to have funds to protect these sort of places, conservation easements, and also historic structures around the state. It's one of the best historic commissions in the state. And with a grant from them, we were able to purchase the property. And then we put about $20,000 in it to stabilize it. It was a plantation house built by the Seays, S-E-A-Y, in the 1840s. And then was after 1890s or so, it was purchased by the Campbells. Mm-hmm. And then they had it until 1990. And in the 1990s, when the last sister, it was three Campbell sisters who lived there, and the last one passed away in the 1990s, and it went up for auction and was purchased. But the thing that we all have to remember when we're thinking of preservation is when we're riding around, we're not only looking at the houses that are dilapidated, but we're also being cognizant of the fact that the ones that are in good shape now will be the ones that would be vulnerable later. This house that we found with 10% of the roof off, the mantles stolen, plaster falling in from the rain, in the 1980s, when Richland County would have historic tours, they'd open their house and it was a big place. It seemed to be functioning and fine, but unfortunately, when it got out of the hands of the owners and the people who had it weren't able to maintain it, and we were able to step in and help them with it and gave them a solution for selling. And within a year, we had a young couple from England who saw it on the web, and they said, we want to come there. She is from Louisiana, so they wanted to move to Eastover and restore the house, and they have made it a home. And now they're contributing to the community, and it's just a wonderful success story. Yeah.
And the name of that place is Laurelwood, if anybody has any.
That's right. The name of the place is Laurelwood. It was interesting. I was talking with Andy Chandler, which is with Archives and History, and we were talking about there was these write-ups about a house called Sandhill. Sandhill. And where was it? Well, we found out this was it. This was the Sandhill plantation that the Seas had referred to. And if anybody remembers, when you go on Garner's Ferry Road, there's a place where the road splits with a cemetery in the middle of it, near an older Baptist church. Mm-hmm. Near there was a place called Sandhill Mercantile, and it was a two-story old store.
I remember it.
You remember
it?
Well, we got involved with that when the county condemned it to be demolished. I immediately contacted owners. They had donated the building to us. Richland County backed off. And within 2 months of us getting in the news and we were going to have people restore it, arsonists burned it in before Christmas of 2008, and it was lost, which was really sad. However, because of our involvement in that, we walked down the little dirt road in the woods behind it, and that's where this house. So Sandhill Mercantile, the name was derived from the plantation in the woods behind it, as many of our little communities that grew around plantations are.
Okay. Well, you know, I keep looking at the list of success stories you've had recently, and over in Darlington County, at Society Hill, is another one. So, we hit a different part of the state.
Yeah, Darlington County, Society Hill, we have a very good friend and past board member, Dr. Ernest Helms, Chip Helms. He won a governor's award several years ago for his investment in time in trying to save the buildings of the area of Society Hill. Chip had come in and had saved it. And we were able to step in and take the place over and market it and try to find the right people who would want to make it a new home. So next door to the Caleb Coker house was the Somperack store. And the Somperacks had had it for several generations. The frame structure of the store, we believe, was built in 1815, one of the oldest frame store structures in the state outside the tidal region. And so we purchased it, took us a while to work through the heirs' property of the place, and we had a wonderful sale there of some of the old stuff that was left in it. But all the original 1815 shelving is there, and it's just a magnificent place. So the reason we knew we had to get the store was it was pretty much in front of the Caleb Coker House. So if we were going to sell the Coker House, we needed to tie it to the store. And we were trying to find the people who could use both, live in the house and use the store as some sort of commercial. And we found them. They were folks who came down and saw it, and they loved it. He's an attorney, and they're going to have it. They're going to start restoring the home. The doors have been stolen out of it years ago, and they have reproduced the doors how they look out of heart pine to put them back in. The store is going to be a center of her children's line, clothing line, and it's being put to use again. And so that's something that really shows the success, and it's really exciting to see that come back.
Well, and you had a grist mill down in Somerton, didn't you?
Yes. That was really fun. This had just started happening. In fact, the grist mill we had just sold to these folks within the past month and a half, the Sin Grist Mill. And the grist mill is here. They had a bottling plant, and a bottling plant meaning it was basically the size of a store, and they had the mechanism in there to where they could bring the bottles, put in the syrup, and sell it.
Yeah, people forget that in the days of today, you know, the big bottling plants, Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, what have you, is every little small town had Cheerwine.
That's right. Well, and what became Cheerwine started in this little store, actually, this little place. So you had a grist mill, which is, you think of water wheels and all that thing. But no, they had engines, international tractor engines. They took off tractors and put there in behind to run the little stone grist mill that's in a little probably 3 foot wide stone inside a little engine that grinds the corn. And then next door to it was a blacksmith shop. And the blacksmith shop is phenomenal. The original Sin owner closed up the blacksmith shop in 1940, and everything was still in it. So you have an original blacksmith shop sitting here with all the stuff still in it, everything, just like he left it. Even the old wagon wheel was still sitting in the vise waiting for the hoop to go around the wheel. Astonishing. So when the Sin family came to us and said, we want
to... like a time capsule.
It was a time capsule. And so was the grist mill. And that just shut down in late 80s, right before Mr. Sin passed away. The family put it on the National Register in the late 80s, early 90s, and it sat there empty ever since. And so the family approached us and said, well, y'all are saving buildings, but we want to save this. This is more than the building. This is the history of the town, and it harks back to when communities were self-sustaining. You know, they were able to provide their own farmers with feed for their cows. Mm-hmm. And blacksmiths, you know, you could work on your own farm equipment coming in. And so that was an extra challenge on this. And so it took us about a year, but we found a group that came in. They're going to actually use the store to sell their pecan products out of. And they already have people coming to work with them to run the grist mill. And the blacksmith shop, there are several traditional blacksmiths that are very eager to want to come up once a month and just get things cranked up and see what happens with tourists coming by to see. So it's fascinating to see people with enough imagination to say, let's give this a chance, just like we did with the Wilkins House. It's worth giving a chance to.
Well, what about the bottling plant?
The bottling plant is the mechanisms and the equipment in the bottling plant is gone. There's one wheel and stuff left, but they're going to just use that as a store to sell the pecan products out of. But also, if a blacksmith is found that wants to come in and make crafts and make things out of the shop, that could be sold there potentially, and getting the grist mill going. So these folks are ready to create partnerships with people who want to make this happen again. And the great thing about Somerton is Somerton is right off of I-95. So the potential of Somerton to be a place that people will have a reason to get off of 95 and come and just enjoy a small town with some things that they can't see anywhere else, here's an opportunity to build something there. And that's what we're excited about. And preservation does that.
Well, the bottling plant, and I just thought about Cheerwine and the fact that I think it was actually one to Orange was there, but you said Cheerwine.
Orange was there, and they had other lines that they did, and what became Cheerwine was in there as well.
And see, that's part of not just the southern rural scene, but the American country.
That's right.
outside.
That's right.
But we Southerners took to our soft drinks.
Yes, with the peanuts in the top.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. That was the thing that was the most thrilling to me about that place was, you know, when we took on those places, I wanted to emphasize, let's try, you know, we want to save the buildings because the buildings can be interchanged with uses in it. And when anybody would come to us, say, well, can we get rid of this equipment? I said, no, we've got to try to see if we can reuse the historic use as well. This is not just a historic fabric. This is the use. And now that we have more localism growing, certified South Carolina, we saw that as kind of an opportunity to say, let's see if we can dovetail this use into the growing trend for localism of our food production and work and local economy. And that ties right into this little tin-covered building built in 1900. So from the Wilkins Mansion, fine Italianate right out of Samuel Sloan's pattern book from the 1870s, to Miss Frances's little vernacular cottage that she taught generations of the Fuskey African-American students there, to the Sins who came from Newberry in the 1890s and started their own little blacksmith shop and then gristmill.
That was a good German name that strayed out.
They came out of Newberry County, and they moved down there in the 1890s. But it reflects the diversity of what South Carolina was and is that we want to make sure is remembered and protected. And we were able to have a really good year in doing that this year.
Well, I know some community organizations, particularly in the smaller towns, have made an effort to save outbuildings, particularly traditional barns. I mean,
One of the most heartbreaking things is seeing the barns collapsing all over the state and the neglect.
A few years back, the folks up at Clemson did a book on barns in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. But one of the things you talked about passing that store going on the way to the beach, the old way to the beach, you used to see tobacco barns everywhere.
Who would have thought 40 years ago that tobacco barns would be gone? I mean, just the thought that these little stacked tobacco barns, such an iconic thing on the landscape of the PD, it shows how shifting social things can change. And so how do you maintain them? What do you do? And so that's the issue on how we can help maintain that sort of stuff.
I don't want to say they were flimsy structures, but they were not, they usually were tar paper.
That's right. They were usually stacked logs, pine logs that were maybe 2 or 3 inches thick, which were, they weren't hard pine. Mm-hmm. They were utilitarian. They were meant for a specific purpose that was cheap and to do the job. Same thing in the upcountry with sharecropper houses. And one of the things we're really working on is with Joe McGill and the Slave Dwelling Project, the slave cabins that are left. And things that have lost their original use still have a story to tell, and how do you make sure they can still communicate that, and how our landscape can communicate that to folks. When people talk about tourism is more than just the destination of the beach, or even the destination of Charleston, as important that is. But more and more tourists are getting off the freeways and driving around and seeing and wanting to experience the South Carolina that we grew up with, that is that traditional.
Well, speaking of that, any outhouses on your list?
Yes. I would love. No, it's not there yet. But that's part of the thing. You know, when you go to a house and you can see the old complex still there, every year you see more, less and less and less of that. And in a state with a lot of rain and a lot of termites, those sort of buildings tend to be the first ones to be gone, and you end up with reproductions instead of the real things.
Yeah. You know, people say, well, why would you do that? The outhouse or the necessary was a part of South Carolina, and not just rural life. In 1950 in Columbia, a majority of the homes didn't have indoor plumbing. That's obviously changed in the last 80 years, but that's 1950.
Well, but it also communicates the complexity of our past. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to create this one-dimensional world where, you know, we don't need to think about how we got here and, oh, look at all the future going. But, you know, we have to understand the nuance of how we did get here and the memory of that. Mm-hmm. And that can be reflected in the buildings and the built environment.
Well, see, back of the big house wasn't just the slave quarters or the tenant farms. There were the barns, there was the granary, there was the chicken coop, there was the necessary. I mean, it was all
of that was there. So, you know, very few places have all of that. many places still have one or two elements of it, and that's one of the things we really try to communicate is, you know, just keep the tin on that old corn crib back there. That's mm-hmm. that's something that's really adds to the historic flavor of the home that you're showing me and you're so proud of, which you should be proud of. But that corn crib helped make that home available. That slave cabin mm-hmm. helped make that home available. All of those were pieces and integral as much as the foundation of the house were those things there, because that's why they were there, and that's helped tell that monumental story and gives mm-hmm. a color.
What about larger structures that we've had to deal with losing? Mills, tobacco warehouses. The latter is just, you know, now that the tobacco auctions are a thing of the past.
Finding a use for that. I mean, we met with folks in Mullins with their huge tobacco warehouse trying to figure out a use, trying to see. And the thing that Charleston accidentally discovered was when you leave stuff alone, when you don't have the money to change everything quickly like Charleston didn't do in the first half of the 20th century, you realize, oh, wow, we still have this stuff. You know, and even though you don't have a use for it now, doesn't mean it can't be a use for it later. So take your time, be patient, and allow for that use to come along, and it will.
Well, Mullins has got a wonderful tobacco museum.
Yes.
But the whole town is a 19th century gem.
It is. It is.
Main Street, bungalows, a few big houses. I mean, it's an incredible treasure.
Well, it is, and the thing that's so heartbreaking is trying to figure out in these towns where, for whatever reason, Mullins still survived, but these towns were built artificially because of the railroad happened to stop there.
Yeah.
You know, the railroad needed to get water and coal. It stopped there.
And that's why the tobacco warehouse was
and
there.
That's why the tobacco warehouse was there. They were an unnatural entity. It didn't mm-hmm. just happen because of laissez-faire. I mean, it happened because of plan. And usually somebody knew, we're going to get the railroad stop here, and we're going to lay out the streets, and we're going to create this town. Well, when the railroad went away, you know, are we going to be near the freeway? Because that's the new railroad, you know, the freeway and the interchange. And who can have the interchange? And that's where commerce happens now. But you go into so many of these towns, and you just see they can survive again if you get enough people with intention to put that intention back into these places. Because now with transportation, you don't need to live within 5 minutes of where you work, you know, like in the small towns where you had more density. So to try to bring people and give reasons to come back to the small towns, into these communities that tap into the things that help build them, that's what's really exciting. When we see something, what happened in Somerton, we actually got someone to want to buy these three little buildings.
Well, Mike, we've got just a few more minutes. Let's go back to the organization again. Remind folks how you work and how they can be on the lookout. I guess people in their communities need to be aware of what's out there.
They need to be aware of what's out there, and they need to be aware that there's a lot of ideas and solutions. And this is why having a statewide preservation organization is so important, because we can help share the successes of what's happening in towns across the state with a town that calls up and says, how do we deal with this issue? And we could come in with the issue of tax credit. And, you know, we just passed the abandoned buildings legislation that helped to bring investment into abandoned buildings. And to help communicate information and create a web of support for people who are preservation-minded. And that's why statewide is so important, an organization that can come in and help give solutions to the preservation issues in your community and help build a preservation community statewide that can make a difference.
Well, one of the things you said earlier when we were talking about the tobacco warehouses is that in society today, everybody wants the quick fix. When I talk to someplace, I'll say, Newberry's great. Well, how can we be the next Newberry? Well, Newberry didn't happen overnight.
That's right. That's right. It took years, and it took a very dedicated, small group of people to take the lead and show the way to get people support to restore that opera house. And that investment and that intention, putting intention into things, it cannot be underestimated. Help create the intention and the example for the other buildings on the square. And now it's a destination for people all over the region.
Okay. All right, Mike, I'm sorry Alfred is giving us the wind-up. Any last words for our listeners before we sign off today?
Well, thank you, Walter. It's just such an absolute honor to be in a state I love so much and to be able to participate in the saving of the places and the buildings that give this state such a unique identity. It's wonderful to be part of that, and we look to build a community of like-minded people in the state and even folks around to participate and help us make this work so that your grandkids will know South Carolina that we love.
Well, Michael Biedenbaugh, the Executive Director of the Palmetto Trust for Historic Preservation, thanks for being with us today on The Journal.
Thank you, Walter.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. It's always a pleasure to have Michael Biedenbaugh of the Palmetto Trust on the show. We have him every couple of years, and in many ways, it's a report to the folks of South Carolina about what the Trust has been able to do. And the last few years have been very successful for an organization that operates pretty much on a shoestring and with the help of devoted volunteers across the state. It's a story that's important if we are to retain the built landscape or portions of the built landscape that has shaped generations of South Carolinians. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina ETV Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina ETV Radio.